Today's Teisho will be on case 62 in the Heikigan Roku. Case 62 is entitled Umon's One Treasure. Engo's Introduction. With the untaught wisdom, he engages in the subtle action of inaction. With unsolicited compassion, he becomes your true friend. With a single word, he kills you and saves you. In one move, he lets you go and holds you fast. Tell me, who is it that comes in this way? See the following. Umon said to the assembled monks, between heaven and earth, within the universe, there is one treasure. It is hidden in the mountain form. You take the lantern, entering the Buddha hall, and you place the lantern above the temple gate. Secho's verse, look on the ancient bank. Who is that holding the fishing rod? Quietly moving clouds, boundless waters, the bright moon, the white flowers of the reeds. You see by yourself. So I want to thank everybody for taking the time out to practice this beautiful path of Zen on this beautiful day. And we've had to contend with multiple waves of the pandemic, and they have made it necessary for us to be meeting online, and we will continue to operate online, but we will hope that in the May we'll be able to return to Murray Grove as well, so that we'll have an online option and an in-person option. But there are definitely challenges to practicing like this. This is wonderful in many ways. We wouldn't be able to practice together at all if it weren't for this technology. And so that makes it, miraculous. And we have people who are in the Sesshin who are far away in Ireland or New York, and they're able to participate, or California and Alaska, so all good. On the other hand, it's difficult to practice at home, right? I mean, we are sharing, many of us share a domicile with somebody else, with other people or another person. That person has had to make sacrifices for us to be able to practice. And one thing we should do after the session is over is thank those people who made it possible, whose consideration and support made it possible for us to practice like this. Thank you for making such an excellent effort, and we should thank those who supported that excellent effort. I want to, we're practicing right now at home, but I want to make an argument for home leaving. When the Buddha was a young man, he had the experience. In the sutras, it said that he actually, in the literature, not actually in the sutras, but in the Buddhist literature, it says that the Buddha became aware of human suffering when he saw an old person, a sick person, and a dead person. According to the Buddha legend, the Buddha was the son of a king. And the king, fearing a prophecy, tried to protect his son from recognizing the uncertainties and difficulties of our lives. The prophecy at the time of the Buddha's birth was that he would either be a great leader, a great political leader, what is called in Indian tradition a world-turning monarch. A wheel-turning monarch. He would either be a wheel-turning monarch, in other words, who would turn the wheel of existence, right? Or he would be a great liberator, sage, like a sage. And the king, according to the legend, was so afraid that his son would take option B that he tried to protect him from any recognition of human suffering. And according to the legend, the Buddha, against the wishes of his father, went out of the royal compound and saw a sick person, an old person, and a dead body. And this set him on a journey towards enlightenment. He realized the precariousness of our existence. That story is probably not quite true. You know, from what we know about records, about what we know from the records that are now available, we know a lot about the Buddha's early life. The Buddha's father was probably a clan leader. So, like in Scotland, you have people familiar with Western history, you know, there were these clans in Scotland, the MacGregors and the Campbells and so on. And they had a loose system of alliances. And basically, there was like a leader for each of the clans or extended familial groups in Scotland. Well, there was something like that in northeastern India. And the Buddhist people were called the Shakya people. And they had a parliament building. They had a democracy, actually, where people would go and vote. And his father was probably like a prime minister or a speaker of the house or something like that. So he wasn't really a king. And it seems to me that it's very unlikely that the Buddha never saw any sick people, you know, until he was a young adult. But it's probably the case that he did leave home, right? It's probably the case that he did leave home. That is to say, after he became aware of the precariousness of human existence and the universality of suffering, right? He decided not to become a political leader like his dad or a wheel-turning monarch, as the legend says. But he set off on a journey of discovery, you know, trying to decide what it means to be awake. What does it mean to be awake, to be truly awake? And in order to do this, the Buddha left his family. So the Buddha actually got married before he left. He married a beautiful princess, according to the legend, and had a beautiful baby boy, had a beautiful son. And so he's wealthy. Whether he's a prince or not, he's in the upper level of his society. He has a father who's a distinguished figure. Whether he is a king or not, we don't know. He has a beautiful life companion and a child, right? So all the things that would make life good, a good life, he had, and yet he left it all behind. He left his family. He abandoned his wife and his son, and he went to look for enlightenment. This is like really an interesting and radical point, right? that in order to wake up, the Buddha actually had to say goodbye to all of these things that we are still told make life good, make life worth living. And you know, basically, when the Buddha set off on this journey of discovery, he studied with some great meditation masters, and he eventually achieved awakening on his own. He studied with the two foremost meditation teachers in his society. And both of them taught him different things that he used in his meditation practice. One of them taught him emptiness, like mushin, and he decided that even though mushin was valuable, it wasn't enlightenment. And the second thing he taught them was, the second thing he learned from one of these teachers was that there's a state of existence which is like timeless, and there's no space and time. But he decided that wasn't enlightenment either. And finally, because he could find no one to teach him, he set off on his own and practiced meditation until he individually had an awakening experience. So not only did he leave like his family and his, you know, prospects for future employment and so on, he also left like the foremost experts of his society, the professors of his time, and he went off on his own in this quest for truth. So when the Buddha had his enlightenment experience, it's always interesting to me that he had many lay disciples. As I mentioned earlier in the session, the Buddha had lots and lots of people who were not monks and nuns, but he himself never returned to his family. He never went back. After enlightenment, he didn't go back to the palace. He didn't go back to his wife and son. And he never actually saw his father again, right? So this is really challenging, right? This is really challenging. The Buddha's son eventually became a monk. So the Buddha's descendants don't exist. No, there are no descendants of the Buddha. His descendants don't exist. His son became a monk and had no children. His wife became a monk, a nun. And that's the end of that family. So this is like a strange thing for me to say. You know, I'm saying home leaving is really important in Buddhism. And it sounds like what I'm saying is that everybody should quit their jobs, leave their wives and husbands, and go to a monastery right away. But that's not what I'm saying. It's not what I'm saying. If you want to do that, think it over. But that's not what I'm recommending here, okay? What I'm talking about is home leaving as a practice. Home leaving as a practice. See, home leaving is our practice all the time. I live in a house. I have a job. I get a paycheck every 2 weeks. I have obligations. I'm married. You know, I have family members. You know, I care about them. So I haven't quit my job. I don't live in a monastery. I haven't left my wife, you know, and so on. But I still think that home leaving is in a certain way my path in life. You know, home leaving is my practice. So, you know, part of home leaving means carving out time to do this, right? You have to actually, I've often said that sesshin is the heart of Zen practice. You know, it's very important for people to do regular weekly practice and ideally even daily practice. And it's very important to try to come to Sesshin like once a year, at least, so that you're going through this process of home leaving in like a deep way, right? And it's not always possible for people to do that because our jobs and our family obligations are very demanding, and we need to be good mothers or good fathers. I'm a teacher. I want to be the best teacher I can be. It's always a challenge to carve out some time to come to Sesshin. And, you know, when I come to Sesshin, day one of Sesshin, it's always the same drama, you know. I find myself on day one thinking of all the stuff I need to do or haven't done, right? And by day two, that becomes a little bit less obsessive and nagging. And I can begin to breathe more freely and be in the moment. You know, I've talked about this before, but, you know, when I was in graduate school, I started sitting with Genki Roshi. And everybody I knew warned me against doing this. They didn't say the Buddhism was bad, but they just said, you know, you're a graduate student. You know, you should not be spending your time doing Zen practice. In fact, my dissertation director said to me, "You are making a terrible mistake. You're throwing your career away by doing this. You know, the time you're spending on meditation practice and Sesshin, you could be spending on publishing articles." So basically, I fortunately ignored what he said, and I kept practicing. But I would get to the Zen house every morning, and I would sit down, and for a minute, I would be seized with panic. Because I would think to myself, what am I doing here? I should be working on my dissertation. I should be doing this. I should be doing that. And I would literally feel like I was just about to jump up and run out, except I couldn't run because I came with John Sunstein in his Volkswagen bus, and we were 20 miles from my house. But I still wanted to. And then I realized, okay, I can't run away. I, John has to drive me back. I might as well just be here now. And, you know, that was like magic. You know, that's like home leaving, letting it go. See, so in that moment, I didn't have a TA ship. You know, I didn't have bills to pay. Those were for other moments. For that moment, I could be here in the present moment without those concerns, without those fears and attachments. And I could just be present with the moment in a way that made no demands of the moment and that brought no baggage to the moment. And this is so beautiful and so liberating and so hard to achieve. It's so hard to disentangle ourselves, right? To disentangle ourselves. You know, it's so hard to come to the moment, to the world, with an unencumbered mind and a truly open heart, because we get so tangled up. And so it was so precious. And in fact, it made it possible for me to get through graduate school. You know, being able to have, actually it was like 2 hours in the morning, where I was just present with what is, you know. I would have that panic attack, and then I would realize I can't get out of here. And then I would start doing my zazen, start breathing, following the breath, entering mu. And, you know, Genki Roshi used to open the windows of the zendo every morning. We would arrive, And he would open the windows, and it would be like 30 degrees outside. And he'd open the windows to make it like a Zen temple in Japan. And I would have a sweater, and I also had like this, you know, army surplus wool shirt that I wore. And I, you know, but it would always be cold, right? And I came in, I sat down, and he didn't open the window, and I thought, oh, he's forgotten. Wonderful, you know, but he didn't. Then he'd get up and open the window. I was like, ah, you know. And I would sit in the cold and the dark, right? But it was so beautiful just to be in the moment. And it was so hard for me to be in the moment all day. All day, I'm thinking of the future, or I'm worried about consequences of the past. And that was so freeing for me. I think it made it possible for me to, you know, be successful in what I was doing. But if I had been worried about being successful in what I was doing, I would have been crippled by all kinds of fears and self-doubt and so on and so on, you know. So I had like a 2-hour period every morning of leaving home, like leaving it. And, you know, Sesshin is leaving home. You know, day one, we haven't left home. You know, we're thinking, oh my gosh, I've got this, I've got that. You know, why did he say this? Why did he say that? And that is like this screen of expectation and anxiety and self-doubt, you know, it colors everything we look at, right? It colors everything we look at. And we don't notice it so much because it becomes, it's second nature, right? We're not aware of it. After a while, it seems like our authentic self. It seems like this is our real life, right? You know, I'm constantly struck by how manipulated we are, you know, how incredibly manipulated. Everybody is selling us on something, right? They want us to be a certain kind of person. So, you know, a friend of my wife's brings us his old news magazines. I don't know if you ever read, The Week. The Week, it's a abbreviated news magazine that sort of is a summary of the week's news. And I actually look at them when I'm, you know, eating my breakfast, I'm sorry to say, you know, and there were a stack of them, and I looked over and it just hit me, right? You know, I'm looking at this, the backside of this weekly magazine, and it has a picture of a watch. And it was a watch company that was making a low-priced watch that people would think was a high-priced watch, right? So it's saying you can get, and I can't remember the brand, but it said you could get a watch, like you could get a such and such. It's, you know, for $150, you know, and it's like you would wear that around and you'd, oh, I'll check the time for you. Oh my gosh, you've got a such and such watch, you know. You must be, you know, very successful, right? And, you know, they're selling you an image. You know, now you can project this image in public of yourself as a very successful person and you can get a good deal. Right? And they're preying on our insecurities, right? They're preying on the insecurities of like, this is my Timex. It's my Timex Expedition watch. It's $56 at Target, right? So look, you know, they're preying on our anxieties, our status anxieties, our lack of self-worth, and they're selling us an image. But people do that all the time. You know, they're constantly inflicting on us things that cause us anxiety and a sense of inferiority and so on. You know, I was in remedial education when I was finishing up my PhD. I taught in something called the Educational Opportunities Fund for the University of Washington. And my students were mostly working class Hispanics, and they were East Asian immigrants whose language skills were very sketchy. And also a large number of African American students from LA and other parts of California. So these students were not well prepared for college. And I signed up for this because I wanted to be helpful. I have a commitment. I do have a commitment to social justice. I want everybody to have a shot at a good life. And I started teaching this course, and my students were so unresponsive and so irresponsible, and they seemed undisciplined. And I was, first couple of weeks, I was failing as a teacher. And I went into class, and one guy actually stuck up his hand, and he said, "Isn't your job to inspire us?" And I, what do you mean? He meant, you're not inspiring, you're not interesting, you know. And I wasn't, I admit, you know. Okay. So I went to see my supervisor, who was this African-American poet named Colleen McElroy. And she said, "You should come and see my class." And I went to her class, and she ran her class like a drill sergeant. She didn't yell at people, but it was very structured. And people had expectations. And if they didn't meet the expectations, she let them know. Right. And she said, after I went to her class, she said, "Kurt, do you ever have a dream where you go to school and you haven't studied for the test and you realize and you're filled with panic?" And I said, "Oh, yes, I have that dream all the time. And I still have it, you know." And she says, "They don't have that dream. You have to give them that dream," she said. "You have to make them feel panic if they don't have their work done." Right. So, you know, actually I wanted to do well, and I never quite got into the drill sergeant mode, M-O. But I did take her point, you know, and I had to make a much more structured class, and I had to make them worry. You know, I had to make them worry. So, you know, actually my job as a teacher is to make my students worry, you know. Now that I had the best intention, and actually the students benefited. But all the same, you know, it's very difficult in our society to be unworried and unmanipulated. Right? It's very difficult to be unmanipulated, you know. Generally speaking, even when we're not being manipulated, we're being manipulated. So, you know, I know a lot of people who, when they're stressed, I have friends who will do something like this. They will buy a quart of Häagen-Dazs ice cream. And when they're stressed, they'll take out the Häagen-Dazs ice cream and they'll eat it. I don't know if you've ever heard of that happening, right? Now, why do they do that, right? Why do they do that? That comes from the movies, right? That comes from the movies. That's an idea. No, nobody actually came up with the idea. Let me look for a release from stress. I'll try eating Häagen-Dazs ice cream. That's a meme, right? That was created in the movies in the 1980s, right? And the Häagen-Dazs company was happy to have it happen. In fact, they probably paid the movie producer, you know, terms of endearment, millions of dollars for product placement, right? But the point is, all of these people have stress, and what they do is they go to the refrigerator and they eat their Häagen-Dazs. And Häagen-Dazs is like loaded with fat. So it's like saying, "I don't care about health. I don't care about anything. I'm just going to have the pleasure of eating Häagen-Dazs." Right? And it feels like a totally natural and expression of yourself. But it's totally scripted by your society. It's a meme that was invented in a movie and picked up by ice cream makers, right? So if you begin to look at our society, so much of our behavior is scripted like this and manipulated. And it's why we can't put things down, right? It's why, you know, we're conditioned to be anxious. People want us to be anxious. They want us to be envious. There are people who spend millions and millions of dollars trying to figure out ways to make us envious of each other, right? I don't know if you've ever seen the commercial of, I don't have to go into too many examples, but Matthew McConaughey sells Cadillacs, right? And he has this bad boy persona. And if you've ever seen him sell Cadillacs on TV, he's driving his Cadillac and he's a bad boy. And then he drives into this mansion, right? And I mean, the whole commercial is about how cool he is and don't you want to be like Matthew McConaughey? And if you drive a late model Nissan or a 2005 Matrix, as I do, you know, you're supposed to feel anxious because you don't have a Cadillac coupe. You know? So you could say, well, it doesn't affect me. I'm resistant, but you're not. Everybody takes this stuff in all the time. And we're acting out these scripts that we didn't write, but we're doing it all the time. Even when we think we're free, we're not free. So, you know, when I was in college, I was a dissenter. I was a hippie and I was a radical. And I was unlike everybody else. And when I would go to school, I would walk into the classroom and I had long hair and I wore a flannel shirt and blue jeans. And when I looked around the room, what did I see? I saw a room full of people with long hair, flannel shirts, and blue jeans, right? You know, this is the meme, this is the script. I felt free, but I wasn't free. So, you know, a lot of our inner lives are not our own. A lot of our inner lives feel like our own because they're our inner lives. But our thoughts, our emotions, our fears and attachments have all been engineered, and we live them out as though they're the deep truth of ourselves, but they're not. So who are we? Where do we come from? And where are we going? And how do we do that? Right? How do we do that? And, you know, the Buddha said, you know, all of this is unreliable. All of this is untrustworthy. You know, leave home. And he didn't mean you have to leave your home. He mean you have to step out of the cultural scripts and out of all these fantasies, these collective mythologies and so on, and have a encounter with this moment, an open, unscripted encounter with this moment. And that is what Zazen is all about, right? You know, we sit down on the cushion and we go into Mushin for a reason. You know, Mushin is emptiness mind. It's like everything is zero. Everything out there is zero. It doesn't matter. Right? And what we're doing is deconditioning the mind. We've been very highly conditioned. All societies condition people. We're very highly conditioned. And what Mushin does is start to strip away it's deconditioning, de-brainwashing, right? So, you know, you go into absolute emptiness and then you experience the moment in this unscripted way. And it can, you know, you don't rush to the refrigerator for the Häagen-Dazs, or you don't think, why am I not driving a Cadillac coupe? You know, you notice the grass and you hear the birds and you think, this is who I really am. This is what I really am. And, you know, even though we have all of these self-doubts and all of this anxiety, you know, this life that we experience, we realize we're connected to something bigger than Kurt, you know, bigger than Bob, you know, that it's this beautiful, beautiful thing that we're part of, you know. And this is discovering this, you know, in a radical way is what we call Daikensho. And we have glimpses of this. We have moments where we're in this, it's called in Buddhism, thusness, tat ata. We're in the thusness. You know, it's just the pure presence of the moment without any values attached to it and any price tags and any measurements. And when we experience that, it's so beautiful to be alive. And we realize this is infinitely precious. This is Uman's one treasure. You are the light. You are the light. You know. So you know, leaving home is a practice. Our word for it is sometimes mushin. Mushin, right? We leave all of that back there and we come to the moment with like empty mind, the empty mind. And we do this over and over again. So always in a certain way, leaving home. And it's very important to, you know, like carve out the time to leave home. You know, we're all very busy. We're all very busy, but you know, we try to make a couple hours a week, you know, at least. And, you know, if you had the time, you know, an hour a day, you know, it's not a lot, really. I mean, if you ask yourself how much, you know, many people watch, I was just reading the other day, the average person watches like 5 hours of television a day. It seems unbelievable. But somebody's watching all that TV, you know. And if you can make 45 minutes of time, you know, every couple of days, that would be good. If you could do it every day, that would be even better. Just leave home for a little while, like, you know, an hour every couple of days, an hour a day, you know, 45 minutes a day. And then you make time for this, right? And you can't do it all the time. You know, I have a lot of control over my time, luckily, but, you know, the session is so special and so precious because, you know, it takes a few days to really like deep deconditioning. And, you know, it's really like around day two where people are beginning to put it all down, to put it down. And around day three, they begin to have these moments where they're just in the moment, tat ata, thusness. And you know, Zen practice is really about taking apart the world that we've been conditioned to believe in and rebuilding our world of experience starting from zero, from nothingness. And when we experience the world and we're not manipulated or conditioned, it's a very different world. And gradually we keep adding back more and more of what we took away initially, right? But it's the price we have to pay is that we really have to step out sometime. We really have to step out of the world to do this. And that takes planning and it takes discipline, right? And it takes sacrifice. It takes some sacrifice. You know. But if you do it, I think, you know, the teaching is that this is the way to wisdom. This is wisdom is not doing what society says is the thing to do. Wisdom is acting from that place of truth in yourself, which is homeless. It's a homeless truth, you know. It's so we don't have to be monks and nuns, but we all have to practice homelessness. And if we practice homelessness, what do we find? We find what Urmang Yunmen calls the one treasure. And there's no, that one treasure isn't in Wall Street, and it isn't in, you know, California. You know, although Ventura is very nice, it's not in Ventura, California, right? Umong said to the assembled monks, between heaven and earth, within the universe, there is one treasure. It's hidden in the mountain form. Would you like to see the mountain form? That's the mountain Umong is talking about. You, when you're on the cushion, when you're on the, you're the mountain form. Umong says to the assembled monks, between heaven and earth, within the universe, there is one treasure. It is hidden in the mountain form. You take the lantern, entering the Buddha hall, and you place the lantern above the temple gate. So, you know, when we practice Zazen and we find the one treasure, you know, then we can take that out into the world. We, having left home, we return home with that light, with that light. And, you know, we keep doing this all our lives. That's the path of Zen. You know, and when we take that light out into the world, you know, we're doing something really wonderful for everybody. So, you know, when you say, look, I'm out of commission for 5 days, you know, I'm sorry, you know, people, are, but then, you know, in Chinese Buddhism, they say, if you have a child who becomes a monk or a nun, it benefits the family for 7 generations. That's what they say. That's like a folk saying in China. If you have a child who becomes a monk or nun, it's a benefit for the family for 7 generations. Now look, families sacrifice a lot, right? You know, they lose a child, they lose grandchildren. Somebody becomes a monk, it's like, you know, a loss. But it's saying everybody benefits from those who are willing to leave home, to step out of the scripts. It's a benefit for 7 generations. So even though you're closing the door, you're saying, I'm sorry, I'm not answering my emails, et cetera, you know, I'm not being, you know, I'm not, if you're a parent, I'm not at my child's beck and call for 5 days, you know, all the same, you know, when you come out, you will be a better parent, you will be a better person, I believe. So thank you all, whether you could be here for a little bit of time or the 5 days or the weekend or some portion. You know, you all left home for some period of time. We have until 6. We have more hours of Zen practice, and we will continue to be home leavers for a little while longer. And let's take that precious time and use it, not just, you know, the Buddhist teaching is for the benefit of all sentient beings. You can't help others if you're not awake yourself. But you know, when you wake up, it's a benefit to everybody. So let's please cultivate the practice of awakening in these remaining hours.